You're listening to the Rusted Culture Podcast. Welcome back to the Rusted Culture, folks. I'm Frank Ebersold. I want to welcome you back to this week's episode. Today, we're going to discuss foreign aid and how it isn't bribery, Mr. Trump. The second thing is we want to discuss Facebook's grand bargain that they're willing to make. And then when Curtis comes in, we're going to talk a little bit about news tidbits, and of course, we'll solve the problems of the world. Stay right there. Well, last week we heard that Trump wants to cut aid to three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Trump said that they're not doing enough to stem the tide of immigration into the United States. My feeling is this, do you really think that Donald Trump knows enough about what's working with the foreign aid that we give and what's not working with the aid that we give so that he can improve the outcomes? My feeling is if he's in a airplane flying at 30,000 feet, this beautiful plane, and he looks down and he sees these issues on the ground, and he feels like he knows everything about them. But at some point, you've got to land the plane, you've got to get down in the weeds, folks, and you got to figure out what's actually going on with the millions of dollars in aid. You've got to do an assessment of what's working and what's not working before you just simply cut the aid off. Nobody is going to dispute that crime, gang violence, and poverty, as well as drug use, is terrible in those three countries. But back in reality, how is cutting the aid off going to make any of that better? So let's start with who in the U.S. administers the foreign aid. Half of the aid that we give, which, by the way, totals just over 1% of the U.S. budget for all the foreign aid, half of the aid is administered by a specialized agency called USAID. That stands for United States Agency for International Development. In 1961, the Foreign Assistance Act was passed by Congress, but before then, there had never been a single agency charged with foreign economic development. And leading this transformation was President John F. Kennedy. President Kennedy recognized the need to unite development into a single agency responsible for administering aid to foreign countries to promote social and economic development. And to quote Kennedy, he said that there's no escaping our obligations, our moral obligations as a wise leader and a good neighbor in the interdependent community of free nations, our economic obligations as the wealthiest people in a world of largely poor people, as a nation no longer dependent upon the loans from abroad that once helped us develop our own economy, and our political obligations as a single largest counter to the adversaries of freedom. To me, folks, being a good neighbor and a wise leader, as Kennedy said, has two obvious benefits. The first one is that China and Russia aren't in those countries. And while accomplishing that goal, we can also improve the country with regard to crime, gang violence, and poverty, which would keep folks from fleeing that country in the first place. So this 30,000-foot assessment by Trump that those countries aren't doing enough, so I'm just going to cut the aid off, just seems like we're really bribing those countries with our aid. And since that doesn't seem to be working, well, we're just going to cut the bribes off. There's so much more than that that's going on with these countries and the aid that we give. In the real world, folks, that's not what's happening with the aid that they get. So for a second, let's go back to the USAID organization who administers this largest chunk of this aid for a second. In the modern day concept of international development assistance took shape after World War II ended in 1945. George C. Marshall, the Secretary of State from 1947 to 1949, provided significant financial and technical assistance to Europe after the war. Famously known as the Marshall Plan, this was a successful effort that allowed Europe to rebuild its infrastructure, strengthen its economy, and stabilize the region. So that's the agency. That's the USAID agency and why they're here. In terms of what USAID does today, according to the website, they do a number of things, but one of them I thought was interesting. It says that they prevent the spread of pandemic disease, in addition to counteracting the drivers of violence, instability, transnational crime, and other security threats. They stand with the people when a disaster strikes or crisis emerges as the world leader in humanitarian assistance. So, in addition to countering crime and poverty, they also help prevent the spread of pandemic disease. So, in my view, treating the aid as we give it to them today, if we treat that like a bribe that we're going to cut off one day or next week or whenever, it doesn't do justice to what's really working, what's actually happening with the aid that we give today, and what the impact of cutting that aid off tomorrow will be. All three countries have fragile democracies, high levels of poverty, food insecurity. And according to foreignassistance.gov, foreign assistance plays a critical role in supporting Honduras' development as a safe, democratic, and prosperous nation so that Hondurans see their future in Honduras and not elsewhere. And according to that website, we gave $66 million in aid this year, and Honduras' per capita income was $2,361. We gave $69 million to Guatemala in 2019, and per capita income there is $4,147. In El Salvador, we gave them $45.7 million in 2019, and per capita income there is $4,224. And I should say, obviously, 2019's not done, but those are pledged amounts, which Donald Trump is looking to cut. And in terms of government, all these three different countries, within each one of those, they're all democratic. And among the top two exports in each country are coffee and clothing, like pullovers, t-shirts, that kind of thing. But in reality here, folks, I think that when we look at these countries and the aid that we give them, I think that we need more than a knee-jerk, just simply pull the money attitude. These are fragile democracies that have tons of opportunity. And do we really need to see these democracies fail and more people flee to the United States by removing their U.S. support? Do we need to see that happen before we actually realize that pulling the money was a bad idea? Being president of one of the largest democracies has responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is doing some homework first to figure out what's working and what's not working and fixing that before pulling support on a whim. It's a standard approach in any business, folks. I'm sure many of you do it every day. It's an assessment. Look at what's working. You make adjustments and you move on. Why can't we do that here and now? Well, stay right there. We've got more coming up. Well, folks, the same social networks that millions of us use daily have been hacked. And I'm not talking about the traditional sense here where they're hacking computer data, but they're hacking in terms of extremism. We've been hacked with extremism. People using YouTube and Facebook and Twitter to promote hatred of something. It's hatred of immigrants, hatred of Muslims, the white supremacists. They hate everybody, essentially. You name it, it's all in there. And they're getting worse about how they leverage these platforms to promote their hate. The New Zealand shooter, as the latest example, live streamed his massacre on Facebook. It's not going to go away. It's not going to get any better until we do something about it. It's not going to improve until we do something to take these platforms back from extremism. The anything goes Wild West days are over for the internet, which has become a sort of international utility, and as such, need some common sense regulation to go along with it. So I pulled this story of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg kind of back out of the gutter here that it came through on over the weekend. And I pulled it back out of the gutter before it got washed away and down and out to sea. Because folks, when was the last time you heard of a social media empire tycoon calling for regulation within their industry? When was the last time you heard that? And that's exactly what Mark Zuckerberg did in his op-ed in the Washington Post. He called for regulation over his own business. Well, that sort of caught my eye, and I wanted to know, why would Zuckerberg want regulation over Facebook? And what protects Facebook today that makes Facebook willing to accept this grand bargain of regulation tomorrow? What protects Facebook from liability today? Well, the reason Mark Zuckerberg is getting nervous and is willing to accept regulation is because he fears that a law This law that was passed from this law from 1996, it's called the Communications Decency Act, the CDA, the Communications Decency Act. It may soon be up for further debate and change. And it needs to change, obviously, because it's protecting them, but it's not protecting the networks from all of this hate that's coming through. So the Communications Decency Act made it illegal to knowingly transmit pornography to minors. However, in Section 230 of that law, lawmakers made two concessions that paved the way for explosive growth of Facebook, YouTube, and all the other social media platforms. Firstly, the Act only holds the creators in this Section 230. The Act only holds the creators of harmful content liable for its consequences, not Facebook or YouTube. It holds the creators of that content liable. Secondly, Section 230 prevents liability for good faith attempts to moderate objectionable material. And this all came about, those two additions to the Communications Decency Act, this all came about when a lawsuit back in 1995 ruled that Prodigy Corporation could be held liable as publishers of their customers' content. One facet of that lawsuit stated that because Prodigy removed some of the bad content on its bulletin board forums, well, it sort of agreed that the content that it left was okay. And that was the basis of that lawsuit. Hence, we've got the Communications Decency Act with its two clauses that I just mentioned. So if that law gets tweaked and Facebook and other businesses, if it gets changed, they could be in jeopardy. Their business model, the way that they do business today, would be in jeopardy. I mean, it's a huge deal. It's got huge ramifications if it should be changed. So the basis of Zuckerberg's grand bargain has emerged as a result of that. And what Zuckerberg is proposing is this, and I quote him here. He says that one idea is for third-party bodies to set standards governing the distribution of harmful content and to measure companies against those standards. Regulation could set baselines for what's prohibited and require companies to build systems for keeping harmful content to a bare minimum. And Mark Zuckerberg wants regulation in four areas. And I'll touch on each one of those pretty briefly. The first one is harmful content. He concurs with lawmakers saying that Facebook has way too much power over free speech and that Facebook shouldn't be in the business of making free speech decisions on its own. The second part is election integrity. Zuckerberg says that our systems would be more effective if regulation created common standards for verifying political actors. Something, and Zuckerberg adds that sometimes doing that, and I quote him, he says, sometimes doing that isn't so easy. Third one is privacy. Mark Zuckerberg called for global privacy regulation in line with the European Union's privacy law called GDPR. He also said that artificial intelligence should be included in this legislation or regulation. The fourth one is data portability. If you share data on one service, you should be able to move it to another. Data portability. So, folks, we're really at a crossroads here when you've got Facebook saying that regulation would be a good thing and that lawmakers today, they basically have tremendous leverage over YouTube and over Facebook with the threat of changing the Communications Decency Act in response to all of this extremism that we're getting. That's tremendous leverage. And Facebook is willing to make changes, make concessions. And I'm not a big fan of self-regulation. You know, we've talked about that in the past. But using a third-party entity to do the self-regulation is how the National Association of Securities Dealers was formed back in 1939. The NASD was a self-regulatory predecessor of today's FINRA, as it's called. So yes, self-regulation can work if it's done right, and lawmakers would do a great service to all Americans if they would strike on this legislation to regulate Facebook while the iron is still hot. Let's take this opportunity that we have here, folks, and close this loophole on extremism in our social networks and protect our election integrity in our social networks at the same time. Let's get it done. Well, here we are. This is the news tidbits section here, the Rusted Culture Podcast. And I've got Curtis with us here today, and he's very relaxed because he's just had an hour massage.
Yes.
He's very relaxed, which is good because some of the things we talk about here in terms of
and
politics.
And aromatherapy.
And aromatherapy. My gosh, I think I'm missing out on some of this. But, you know, some of this stuff about politics, it gets your blood pressure kind of going a little bit, doesn't it? Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Big time. So, that's therapeutic. I wish I had that. I'm feeling a little kinked out in my neck right now. But here's what we'd like to do. Some of these stories are kind of interesting, and here's some of the ones that have just come out in the past few days. The accusations against Joe Biden. I mean, my God, what are we going to do? Good Lord, this is, I just want to know, do you think this is how the whole race is going to go? Where things like this pop up, and it's almost to me like the Democrats are sniping on each other. And, you know, I know what he did wasn't good, but I hope I don't get in trouble by saying this, but the people that accused him of inappropriate touching, they even said that what he did doesn't rise to the level of a sexual overtone or anything sexual. They said there was nothing sexual in it. You know, so, yeah. You know, what I'm wondering here is that...
I'm confused.
You know, there are two people that came out, and we've seen the pictures in all of this. One of the ladies in the picture said that, you know, it's not what it looked like, you know, and what I'm going to say here is that the sniping, the level of sniping here, I like all of, at this point, I like all of the Democratic candidates, but when you hear, even Elizabeth Warren came out and said, I believe Lucy Flores, which was one of the people that, you know, is basically complaining at this stage. Senator Bernie Sanders, I have no reason not to believe Lucy Flores. Senator Amy Klobuchar, I have not read Flores' interview, but I know the vice president addressed it there in that statement, and he will continue to address it. You know, my gosh, how much of this are we going to expect now? Is this the way that the Democratic race is going to go? I just think it's a little cheap for them to kind of pile on Joe Biden here, who's got a stellar record, and... You know, he's coming up to a 2020 presidential run. And he said this himself about this inappropriate touching. Joe Biden said, in my many years on the campaign trail and in public life, I have offered countless handshakes, hugs, expression of affection, support, and comfort. And not once, never did I believe I acted inappropriately. If it suggested that I did so, I will listen respectfully. But it was never my intention. So... You know, none of this stuff has really risen to the level of anything sexual that these people that are, you know, bringing this up, these accusations, they said it wasn't sexual. So why the hell are we talking about it? You know, why?
I don't know.
Why is it such a big deal? It doesn't seem like it should be.
You know, I think we've all have encountered individuals that are kind of touchy-feely. And I know I have, and it's, you know...
I like my personal space, too.
And it's... But... Yeah, and it's like, yeah, I can't say that I, you know, I enjoyed it, that I certainly didn't encourage it, but to bring it up and make a public statement about it, I don't think it's... Does it really warrant that kind of attention?
I know, and... You know, we have to treat all of these things with special care. I realize that. And he will never do that again, I'm sure. But it just seems a little, I don't know, over the edge that we're even talking about this. Like I said, none of this, they say, the accusers say, none of this rises to the level of anything sexual. So I think we've given this enough talk in the media. You know, and I just have to wonder how much of this in advance of his campaign, how much of this talk is maybe designed to kind of dampen Joe Biden's chances of running? I mean, is this kind of meant to kind of dampen his enthusiasm down and maybe stay out of the race? The problem I have with it is that he's one of the top runners, you know, in the race. He's coming out of the gate. He's got a lot of attention. Is this why he's getting picked on? You know, I just don't. Yeah, it's just amazing.
You can't help but wonder what allegiance.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing I'm trying to say is let's start this race off in a conciliatory fashion. There's lots of good Democrats out here. I don't know if this kind of sniping, this persistent sort of sniping, it looks a little cheap after a while.
Yeah.
But the next thing that I'd like to talk about here is that the White House security advisor told the House Oversight Committee that 25 denials for security clearance applications were overridden by the Trump administration, according to the Washington Post. And whistleblower here, her name is Tricia Newbold, who has been a White House security advisor for 18 years, said the security clearances were approved regardless of concerns over blackmail, foreign influence, and other concerns, per the Washington Post. And Newbold is the highest-ranking official at the White House to speak out against the Trump administration's actions. And this story is coming to us from Politico. But the thing about it is, and I quote Tricia here, she says that, and this is somebody who's worked in the clearance, security clearance area for 18 years. So I have to give her credit there. She knows what she's talking about, I think. Yeah, after 18 years, she's a professional. So let's give her that credit. And she said that if the president wants to override us, he can, but that doesn't mean at any time that we should alter the way we do business based on what someone may have come out with in the end. I guess the question that I have on this is, you know, we've got this process in place for security clearances, and we've had this for a very long time. Why do we have a process if it's not going to be followed? If at the end of the day, the process that is in place is just something that gets overridden, then why do we have the process? Should we just get rid of the security clearance process? And I don't think that we should. It's there for a reason.
No, absolutely not. But I think that our current president does not value the experience and the advice that's given to him. He's just damn well going to do whatever he wants.
Exactly. And that's my point. That's why I think that you know, the chairman of the Judicial Committee, Jerry Nadler, is looking into this and going to dig a little bit deeper. And of course, the Republicans are going to come out and say that, you know, you're just doing this because you can, just because it's a way to irritate President Trump. But the reality is, if we have a process and we all agree that it's something that we should retain, then by God, let's follow it. So it's not right for the president to just override these security clearances time and time again without and under the cover of darkness. You know, these things need to be brought out, and this is what this lady has done. It's just phenomenal. It's amazing that something like this.
And this is not a Democrat or a Republican
issue.
It's national security at issue.
Exactly. And if Obama had done something like this, what do you think the Republicans would have said?
Oh, my God. We know what would have happened.
It would have been endless. We would have never heard the literal end of it. But like you say, it shouldn't be a Republican or a Democrat issue. It should be a process that's followed. And we know that Donald Trump likes to do things his own way. And that's great. That's fine if that's the way he wants to be. I'm not the biggest fan, obviously, but I think this sort of transcends that sort of do what you want to do approach. You've got things that you have to follow. Mm-hmm. That's why we have a government. That's why we have a security clearance process. But, you know, the next thing I want to talk about here is, what about this health care? Today, Trump vows to pass the best health care plan in 2020 if he gets elected. So that's a little bit of a shift. He was saying that he wanted to overturn and throw out Obamacare. He had joined with the lawsuit that's happening to throw out Obamacare. So today he's pivoted, based on a lot of input from his Republican colleagues, no doubt, that he wants to put that on the other side of the election. So they're going to worry about that after the election now. I just think that in reality, somebody lost the cocktail napkin that actually had the Republican health care plan on it, and they can't find it. There is no plan. The cocktail napkin has been lost, folks. Let's hope they find it. evidently after the election, and they're going to resuscitate this.
Well, I think that they worked 2 years to try and repeal Obamacare without any plan. And they weren't able to do that. So how are they going to do anything in 2020? Does he really think that he's going to have, if he wins, does he really think he's going to have a majority in the Senate and the House? And chances are that that's not going to happen either.
And a normal person would have a plan to replace something if they're getting rid of something so important as healthcare. A normal person would have that plan ready to go, but evidently they don't. They don't. And I said this in one of my previous podcasts. That's the problem. There is no plan. He's twittered away 2 years. They have nothing done in terms of healthcare. And here we stand. So it's another situation where maybe he's taken that 30,000 foot level. You know, he's looking at this thing from the airplane window. And when you actually get down on the ground, there's a lot more details to healthcare than you think.
Absolutely.
It takes more than a scribble on the back of a cocktail napkin. But here's the last story of the day, and I found this one, and it's a little bit of kind of a weird news story. And this is coming to us from Melbourne, Australia. So all the way from Melbourne, Australia, an Australian appeals court last Friday dismissed a bullying case brought on by an engineer. You're a retired engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Who accused his former supervisor of repeatedly breaking wind toward him. His supervisor. So the Victoria State Court of Appeal upheld a Supreme Court judge's ruling that even if engineer David Hink's allegations were true, flatulence did not necessarily constitute bullying. So Hinks said that he's going to take his case to the High Court, Australia's final court of appeal. Don't you think they'll just be elated to get that one on the docket? The 56-year-old is seeking $1.8 million Australian dollars, which comes out to about $1.3 million, in damages. So he's looking for about $1.3 million in damages from his former Melbourne employer, Construction Engineering. So this is where it gets kind of interesting here. Hinks testified that he had moved out of a communal office space to avoid Supervisor Greg Short's flatulence. He moved away from, they probably had a general area, you know, like a bullpen where they had desks set up. So he's saying that this guy was walking around that communal area, letting them rip, you know, here and there. So he moved out of that communal office space. And he told the court that Short would then enter Hink's small windowless office that he had moved to several times a day to break wind. So he moved into like a broom closet, and his supervisor would follow him in there and break wind on him. What sort of hell did that poor guy have to exist in? Hinks alleged that Mr. Short would regularly break wind on him or at him. Wonder what that... how do you break wind at somebody? That's an art, to break wind at someone. Mr. Short, thinking this to be funny, he said, the two appeal court judges wrote in their ruling, and Hinks said he would spray... Hinks said he would spray Short with deodorant and called his supervisor Mr. Stinky. He would fart behind me and walk away. He would do this 5 or 6 times a day, Hinks said outside court. Short told the court he did not recall breaking wind in Hinks' office, but I may have done it once or twice. Oh, gee. Well, I don't know, but Hinks also accused Short of being abusive over the phone, using profane language and taunting him. And we just don't know where this is going to end up. So it's actually going to the High Court, but my gosh, I mean...
So a bully farter.
A bully office farter in Australia. Well, what sort of... Can you imagine going to work just to be either farted around or farted at? I just can't imagine the poor hell this man lived in. But, well, Curtis, that is the news tidbits of the day. I want to welcome you back in for this segment, and we hope to have you all again with us back next week.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Or sooner, if we can think of something that we really want to talk about, and we'll do that. We're looking a little bit more at doing some interviews, guest interviews, so we hope to have something brewed in that respect coming up here shortly. But that is a bun in the oven, as they say.
Oh.
So till then, folks, I want to thank you for joining us here at the Rested Culture Podcast. And till next time, we'll see you then.
Good night.